and pretended to be reading the day's news off her phone, purely to avoid the open staring of the two young men to her right, one of whom seemed determined to make Robin look up, if only to ascertain where the annoying, braying laugh was coming from. To her left, a pair of older men were discussing the imminent Scottish independence referendum.
"Polls are looking shaky," said the first man. "Hope Cameron knows what he's doing."
"They'd be bloody mad to do it, mad."
"There's opportunity in madness, for a few anyway," said the first man. "I remember when I was in Hong Kong. Oh, I think that's our table free."
The two speakers departed for their dinner. Robin glanced around again, carefully avoiding meeting the eyes of the young man with a braying laugh, and a patch of scarlet at the far end of the bar caught her eye. Gemma had arrived, and was standing alone, trying to catch the barman's eye. Robin slid off her barstool and carried her drink over to Gemma, whose long dark hair fell in gypsyish curls to the middle of her back.
"Hi, Linda!"
"What?" said Gemma, startled.
"No, sorry." "Oh," said Robin, looking crestfallen. "Maybe I've got the wrong bar. Has this place got other branches?"
"I've no idea, sorry," said Gemma, still with her hand raised, trying to attract the barman's attention.
"She said she'd be wearing red," said Robin,
looking around at the sea of suits. Gemma glanced at Robin, mildly interested.
"Blind date?"
"I wish," said Robin, rolling her eyes.
"No, it's a friend of a friend who thinks there might be an opening at Winfrey and Hughes. The woman said she'd meet me for a quick drink."
"Winfrey and Hughes? That's where I work."
"You're kidding," said Robin with a laugh. "Hey, you're not really Linda, are you, and pretended to be someone different because you don't like the look of me or something?"
"No," said the other woman, smiling. "I'm Gemma."
"Oh, are you meeting someone or—"
"Supposed to be," said Gemma. "Yeah.
Do you mind me sitting here with you, just till they arrive? I was getting some properly lechy looks over there."
"Tell me about it," said Gemma, as Robin climbed up onto the barstool beside her. The barman now approached a pinstriped, grey-haired man who'd just arrived.
"Oi!"
Robin called, and half a dozen businessmen's heads turned, as well as the barman's.
"She was here first,"
said Robin, pointing sideways at Gemma, who laughed again.
"Wow, you don't mess around, do you? No point, is there?"
said Robin, taking a sip of her water.
She'd subtly broadened her Yorkshire accent, as she often did when pretending to be a bolder, brasher character than she really felt herself to be. "Gotta take charge, or they'll walk all bloody over you."
"You're not wrong there," sighed Gemma.
"Winfrey and Hughes isn't like that, is it?"
said Robin.
"Full of tossers?"
"Well—"
The barman arrived at that moment to take Gemma's order. Once the P.A. had her large glass of red wine, she took a swig and said,
"It's okay, actually. Depends which bit you're working in. I'm P.A. to one of the high-ups. The work's interesting." "Nice guy?"
asked Robin, casually. Gemma drank several mouthfuls of wine before saying,
"He's all right. Devil you know, isn't it? I like the job and the company. I've got a great salary and a ton of friends there. Oh, damn."
Her handbag had slipped off the barstool. As Gemma bent to retrieve it, Robin, whose eyes had roamed across the vista of cream, grey and beige in front of her, suddenly spotted Saul Morris. He just walked into the bar, wearing a suit, an open-neck shirt, and a remarkably smug smile. He glanced around, picked out Gemma and Robin by the bright colours of their dresses, and froze. For a second or two, he and Robin simply stared at each other. Then Morris turned abruptly and hurried back out of the bar. Gemma settled herself back onto her barstool, bag safely on her lap. The mobile phone she'd left lying on the counter now lit up.
"Andy?" said Gemma, answering quickly. "Yeah, no, I'm here already."
There was a long silence. Robin could hear Morris's voice. He was using the same wheedling tone in which he'd tried to talk her into bed, with all those puerile jokes and have-I-upset-yous. "Fine," said Gemma, her expression hardening.
"Fine. I'm going to take your number off my phone now, and I'd like you—" "No, actually, I—"
"Oh, just fuck off."
She hung up, flushed, her lips trembling.
"Why," she said, "do they always want to be told they're still nice guys after they've been total shits?" often wondered that myself, said Yorkshire Robin. Boyfriend? Yeah, said the shaken Gemma. For 6 months. Then he just stands me up one night with no explanation. Then he comes back a couple of times. Booty calls, basically, she said, taking another big swig of wine. And finally he just ghosts me. I texted him yesterday. I said, look, I just want to meet, just want an explanation. Sounds like a right twat, said Robin, whose heart was racing with excitement at this perfect opportunity to have a heart-to-heart. Hey, she called to the barman, can we have a couple more wines and a menu, please? After that, Robin found getting confidences out of Gemma as easy as shelling peas. With three large glasses of wine inside her, and her new friend from Yorkshire being so funny, supportive and understanding, a plate of chicken and polenta to eat, and a bottle of wine, yeah, why the hell not? She moved seamlessly from the misdemeanours of Andy to the inappropriate and unsolicited groping by her boss that had escalated until she was on the verge of quitting. "Can't you go to HR?" asked Robin. "He says nobody'll believe me because of what happened when we were on a course last year. Although, to tell you the truth, I don't really know what happened," said Gemma. And looking away from Robin, she mumbled, "I mean, we had sex, but I was so out of it, so drunk. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't rape. I'm not saying that." "Were you in a fit state to give consent?" said Robin, no longer laughing. She'd only drunk half a glass of wine. "Well, not, but no. I'm not putting myself through that," said Gemma, flushed and tearful. "Not the police and everything, God, no. He's a big shot. He could afford great lawyers. And if I didn't win, how am I going to get another job in the city? Court and the papers? Anyway, it's too late now. People saw me coming out of his room. I pretended it was all okay. I had to, I was so embarrassed. Rumour mill's been in overdrive since. We both denied anything happened. So how would it look if I... Andy told me I shouldn't report it, said Gemma, pouring the last of the bottle into her glass.
Did he?
Yeah.
I told him about it, first time we had sex. See, it was the first time I'd slept with anyone since, and he said, yeah, you want to keep that quiet, be loads of grief for you, and he'll probably get off. He was ex-police, Andy. He knew all about that kind of thing.
You total shit, Morris.
No, if I was going to tell about anything, said Gemma hazily, it'd be the insider bloody trading. Oh, yeah. Nobody knows except me.
1 hour later, Robin and Gemma emerged into the darkening street, Robin almost holding Gemma up, because she showed a tendency to sag if unsupported. After a 10-minute wait, she succeeded in flagging down a taxi and loaded the very drunk Gemma into it.
"Let's go out Saturday,"
Gemma called to Robin, trying to stop her closing the door.
"Fantastic,"
said Robin, who'd given the PA a fake number.
"Ring me." "Yeah, I will. Thanks so much for dinner."
"No problem,"
said Robin. And she succeeded at last in slamming the door on Gemma, who waved at her until the cab turned the corner. Robin turned away and walked quickly back past the Vintry. A young man in a suit wolf-whistled as she passed. "Oh, bugger off," muttered Robin, pulling out her phone to call Strike. To her surprise, she saw she'd missed 7 calls from him. She'd also received an email whose subject line read, "Creed."
"Oh, my God,"
said Robin out loud. She sped up, wanting to get away from the hordes of suited men still walking the streets, to be alone and able to concentrate. Retreating at last into the dark doorway of a grey stone office block, she opened the email. After reading it through 3 times, to make absolutely sure her eyes weren't deceiving her, she called Strike back.
"There you are," he said, answering on the first ring. "Guess what?"
"What?"
"I found Douthwaite."
"You what?"
gasped Robin, attracting the startled attention of a sober-looking city gent shuffling past in the dark, holding a tightly furled umbrella.
"How?"
"Names," said Strike, who sounded elated, and Pat listening to hits of the 70s. "I don't... He called himself Jack first time, right? Well, Terry Jacks had a massive hit with a song called Seasons in the Sun in 74. They played it this afternoon. We know Douthwaite fancied himself a singer, so I thought... Bet that's where he got the idea for Jacks."
Robin could hear Strike pacing. He was evidently as excited as she felt. "So then I went back to Oakden's book.
He said Douthwaite's Longfellow Serenade was a particular hit with the ladies. I looked it up. That was one of Neil Diamond's. So then, said Strike, I start Googling Steve Diamond. I'm about to text you a picture, said Strike. Stand by.
Robin took the phone away from her ear and waited. Within a few seconds, the text arrived and she opened the accompanying picture. A sweaty, red-faced, balding man in his 60s was singing into a microphone. He wore a turquoise T-shirt stretched over a sizable belly. A chain still hung around his neck, but the only other resemblance to the picture of the spiky-haired, cheeky chap in his kipper tie were the eyes, which were as dark and bright as ever.
"It's him," Robin said.
"That picture came off the website of a pub in Skegness," said Strike. "He's still a karaoke king, and he co-owns and runs a bed and breakfast up there with his wife, Donner."
"I wonder," said Strike, "whether she realizes his name hasn't always been Diamond."
"This is amazing," said Robin,
so jubilant that she began to walk down the street again, purely to use the energy now surging through her.
"You're brilliant."
"I know," said Strike, with a trace of smugness. "So, we're going to Skegness. Tomorrow."
"I'm supposed to be...
I've changed the rota," said Strike. "Can you pick me up early? Say 8 o'clock. I'll come out to Earl's Court."
"Definitely," said Robin.
"Then I'll see you..."
"Wait,"
said Robin.
"Oh, shit, yeah," said Strike politely. "Should have asked. How'd it go with Gemma?"
"Great," said Robin. "Shift is insider trading, but never mind that now."
"He's..."
"Strike, I don't want to upstage you or anything," she said, failing to suppress the note of triumph in her voice, "because finding Douthwaite's incredible, but I think you ought to know. You're going to be allowed to interview Dennis Creed in Broadmoor on September the 19th.
Chapter 64. His hand did quake and tremble like a leaf of aspen green, and troubled blood through his pale face was seen to come and go with tidings from the heart, as it a running messenger had been. Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen.
"Well," said Strike, getting into the Land Rover next morning.
They beamed at each other. For a moment, Robin thought she saw the idea of hugging her cross Strike's mind, but instead, he held out his hand and shook hers.
"My Christ, you wait a year for a breakthrough."
Robin laughed, put the Land Rover into gear, and pulled out onto the road. The day was unusually hot. She was driving in sunglasses, yet Strike noted a scarf protruding from the bag behind her seat.
"Don't think you're going to need that. Proper summer weather," he said, looking out at the clear sky.
"We'll see," said Robin skeptically. "We used to visit Skegness when we were kids. Mum's sister used to live in Boston up the road. There's usually a bracing breeze off the North Sea."
"So, I read the email," said Strike, referring to the message Robin had forwarded him, which laid out both the terms and conditions of him interviewing Dennis Creed, and the reasoning which had led the authorities to permit Strike to do it.
"What did you think?" Robin asked.
"Other than being bloody astounded you pulled this off..."
"It took ages."
"I'm not surprised. Other than that, I won't lie. I'm feeling the pressure."
"You mean because of the Tuckers?"
"Yeah,"
said Strike, opening the window so he could light a cigarette.
"Anna doesn't know I'm getting this shot, so she won't get their hopes up. But that poor bastard Tucker..."
Absolute secrecy about the interview, including signing a non-disclosure agreement that guaranteed Strike would never talk to the press about it, had been the first precondition set by the authorities.
"He really wants it to be you," said Robin.
"Tucker. He said Creed's got a big ego and he'll want to meet you, and the psychiatrists must agree, mustn't they, or they wouldn't be allowing it. Brian Tucker says Creed always saw himself as high status and deserving of associating with famous, successful people."
"It isn't a psychiatrist's job to decide whether I'll be able to get anything out of him," said Strike. "I'd imagine all they'll care about is whether I'm going to roil him up. You don't get put in Broadmoor for being mildly eccentric."
Strike was silent for a long time, looking out of the window, and Robin, too, remained quiet, not wanting to interrupt his train of thought. When at last Strike spoke again, he sounded matter-of-fact and focused on the plan for Skegness.
"I looked up the B&B on TripAdvisor,"
It's called the Allardyce, which is his wife's maiden name. We won't walk in there cold, because if he isn't there and the wife smells a rat, she can call him and warn him not to come back. So we'll park, get ourselves into a position where we can see the building, and ring him. If he's there, we walk straight in before he's got a chance to run, or catch him as he leaves, as the case might be. And if he isn't in, we wait.
For how long? Said Robin.
I'd like to say as long as it takes, said Strike, but we're not actually being paid for this, so I've got to be back in town on Monday.
I could stay behind, suggested Robin.
I don't think so, said Strike.
Sorry, said Robin, immediately regretting the suggestion, afraid that Strike might think she was simply after another weekend away in a hotel.
I know we're short-staffed. It isn't that. You were the one who pointed out women have a habit of dying or disappearing around Steve Douthwaite. Could be a case of bad luck. But on the other hand, three different surnames is a lot for a man with nothing to hide. I'm taking the lead on this one.
They arrived in the small seaside town at 11, leaving the Land Rover in a car park beside Skegness Bowl, an enormous red-walled seafront bowling alley. Strike could smell and taste the sea as he got out of the car and turned instinctively towards it, but the ocean was invisible from where he stood. Instead, he found himself looking at a man-made waterway of a murky green, along which a laughing young woman and her boyfriend were pedalling a dinghy-sized boat. The driver's door slammed, and Strike turned to see Robin, still in sunglasses, wrapping the scarf around her neck.
"Told you," she said to the mystified Strike, to whom the day felt unequivocally hot.
Not for the first time wondering what it was about women and their bizarre ability to feel non-existent chills, Strike lit up, waited beside the Land Rover, while Robin bought a parking permit, then walked with her up to Grand Parade, a wide street that ran along the seafront.
"The Savoy," said Strike, smirking, as he read the names of the larger hotels, whose upper windows could surely see the distant sea. "The Corn, the Chatsworth."
"Don't jeer," said Robin. "I used to love coming to Skegness when I was a kid."
"The Allardyce should be up there," Strike said, as they crossed the road, pointing up broad Scarborough Avenue. "Yeah, that's it. The one with the blue awning."
They paused on the corner, beside an enormous mock Tudor hotel which boasted the Jubilee Carvery and Café. Early morning drinkers of both beer and coffee were sitting at outside tables, enjoying the sunshine.
"Perfect place to keep an eye out," said Strike, pointing at one of these pavement tables. "I could use a cup of tea."
"Okay, I'll order," said Robin. "I need the loo anyway. Are you going to call him, or do you want me to do it?"
"I will," said Strike, already sinking onto one of the chairs and taking out his mobile.
As Robin disappeared into the bar, Strike lit a cigarette, then keyed in the Allardyce's number, his eyes on the front of the B&B. It stood in a row of eight tall red buildings, several of which had been converted into small boarding houses and had similar scalloped PVC awnings over the entrances. Spotless white net curtains hung at almost every window.
"Morning, the Allardyce,"
said a Scottish woman, who sounded on the irritable side of brisk.
"Steve there," said Strike, faking casualness and confidence.
"That you, Barrylove?"
"Yeah," said Strike.
"He's on his way now," she said. "We only had a small, sorry. But do me a favour, Barry, and don't hold him up, because there are four beds to change here, and he's supposed to be getting me more milk."
"Righto," said Strike.
And not wanting to speak another syllable that might reveal him to be anyone other than Barry, he hung up.
"Is he there?"
asked Robin anxiously, dropping into the seat opposite Strike. She'd washed her hands in the bathroom, but they were still damp, because she'd been in such a hurry to get back to Strike.
"No," said Strike, knocking his cigarette ash into the small pink metal bucket placed on the table for that purpose. "He's delivering something to a bloke up the road and will be back shortly, bringing milk."
"Oh," said Robin quietly, turning to look over her shoulder at the Allardyce's royal blue awning, on which the name was inscribed in curly white lettering. The barman brought out two metal pots and china teacups, and the detectives drank their tea in silence, Strike keeping a watchful eye on the Allardyce, Robin on Grand Parade. The sea was blocked from her view by the wide, multicoloured frontage of the entrance to Skegness Pier, which advertised, among other attractions, the optimistically named Hollywood Bar and Diner. Elderly people rode mobility scooters up and down Grand Parade,
Families strolled past eating ice cream. Plume-tailed Maltese fat pugs and panting chihuahuas trotted over the hot pavements alongside their owners.
"Cormoran," muttered Robin suddenly.
A man had just turned the corner into Scarborough Avenue, a heavy carrier bag dangling from his hand. His grey hair was close-cropped around the ears, but a few strands had been combed over a wide expanse of sweaty forehead. His round shoulders and hangdog look gave him the air of a man whom life had ground down to a sullen obedience. The same turquoise T-shirt he'd worn in the karaoke picture was stretched tightly over his beer belly. Douthwaite crossed the road, climbed the three steps leading to the Allardyces' front door, and, with a flash of sun on glass, disappeared from view.
"Have you paid for this?" Strike asked, downing the rest of his tea and putting his empty cup back onto the saucer.
"Yes."
"Then let's go," said Strike, dropping his cigarette into the metal bucket and pulling himself to his feet, "before he can disappear upstairs and start changing beds."
They crossed the road as fast as Strike could walk and headed up the front steps, which had been painted pale blue. Baskets of purple petunias hung beneath the ground-floor windows, and an assortment of stickers adorned the glass portion of the front door, one of which announced that this was a 3-star residence, another asking guests to wipe their feet. A tinkling bell announced their arrival. The deserted hall was narrow, its stairs carpeted in dark blue and green tartan. They waited beside a table laden with leaflets about local attractions, breathing in a combination of fried food and a powerful rose-scented air freshener.
"And Paula's got new tubes in her sunbeds," said a Scottish voice, and a woman with short hair dyed canary yellow emerged through a door to the right. A deep vertical line was graven down the middle of her forehead. Bare-legged, she wore an apron decorated with a Highland cow over her T-shirt and denim skirt, and a pair of Dr. Scholl's sandals.
"We've no vacancies, sorry," she said.
"Are you Donner?" asked Strike.
"We were hoping for a word with Steve."
"What about?"
"We're private detectives," said Strike,
pulling out his wallet to hand her a card.
"And we're investigating..."
A hugely obese old lady came into view on the landing above them. She was clad in shocking pink leggings and a T-shirt bearing the slogan, "The more people I meet, the more I like my dog." Panting audibly, she began a sideways descent, both hands clutching the banister.
"A missing person case,"
Strike finished quietly, as he handed Donna his card.
At that moment, Steve Douthwaite emerged from behind his wife, a pile of towels in his arms. Close up, his dark eyes were bloodshot and puffy. Every feature had coarsened with age, and possibly drink. His wife's demeanour, the card in her hand, and the presence of the two strangers now looking at him, brought him to a halt, the dark eyes frightened above his pile of towels.
"Cormoran Strike," murmured Donna, reading the card. "Aren't you the one..."
The old lady, who was barely halfway down the stairs, was now audibly wheezing.
"Get in here,"
muttered Donna, pointing Strike and Robin towards the room from which she'd just emerged.
"And you,"
she snapped at her husband. They entered a small public sitting room with a wall-mounted TV, a sparsely stocked bookcase, and a miserable-looking spider plant sitting in a pedestaled urn. Through an arch was a breakfast room, where 5 tightly packed dining tables were being wiped down by a discontented-looking young woman in glasses, who sped up appreciably when she realised Donna had returned. Robin guessed that they were mother and daughter. Though the younger woman was dark rather than blonde, life had carved an identical groove of dissatisfaction in her forehead.
"Leave that, Kirsty," said Donna abruptly. "Take these towels upstairs, will you, and close the door."
Kirsty relieved Douthwaite silently of his pile of towels and left the room, her slides slapping the bottoms of her sockless feet. The door clicked shut behind her.
"Sit down,"
Donna instructed Strike and Robin, who did so on a small sofa.
Douthwaite took up a standing position, arms folded, with his back to the TV. Frowning slightly, his eyes flickered over Strike and Robin and back to his wife. The sunlight filtering through the net curtains cast an unforgiving light over his hair, which looked like wispy strands of steel wool.
"He's the one who caught that Shacklewell Ripper,"
Donna said to her husband, jerking her head at Strike.
"Why is he after you?"
Her voice rose in both pitch and volume.
"Been dicking around with the wrong woman again, have you? Have you?"
What? Said Douthwaite. But it was obvious this was a stalling tactic. He had understood well enough. His right forearm was tattooed with an hourglass, and around it was wrapped a ribbon with the words, Never Enough.
Mr. Douthwaite, Strike began. But Douthwaite said quickly, Diamond! It's Diamond!
Why are you calling him Douthwaite? Asked Donna.
I'm sorry, said Strike insincerely. My mistake. Your husband was born Stephen Douthwaite, as I'm sure you...
But Donna clearly hadn't known this. She turned, astonished, from Strike to Douthwaite, who'd frozen, mouth slightly open.
Douthwaite? Repeated Donna.
She turned on her husband.
You told me your name used to be Jacks.
I...
When were you Douthwaite?
Ages.
Why didn't you tell me?
I...
What's it matter?
The bell tinkled again, and a group of people was heard out in the hall. Still looking shocked and angry, Donna strode outside to see what was needed, her wooden-soled sandals banging over the tiles. The moment she disappeared, Douthwaite addressed Strike.
What do you want? We've been hired by Dr. Margot Bamborough's daughter to look into her disappearance, said Strike.
The parts of Douthwaite's face that weren't ruddy with broken veins blanched. The enormous old lady who'd been descending the stairs now walked into the room, her wide, innocent face demonstrating total immunity to the atmosphere within.
"Which way's the seal sanctuary?"
"End of the road," said Douthwaite hoarsely. "Turn left."
She sidled out of the room again. The bell outside tinkled.
"Listen," said Douthwaite quickly, as the sound of his wife's footsteps grew louder again. "You're wasting your time. I don't know anything about Margot Bamborough."
"Perhaps you could have a look over your old police statement, at least," asked Strike, taking a copy out of his inside pocket.
"What?"
said Donna, now back in the room.
"What police statement? Oh, for Christ's sake!" she said,
as the bell tinkled again. And she clunked back out of the room and bellowed up the stairs.
"Kirsty! Kirsty!"
"That doctor," Douthwaite said, looking at Strike through bloodshot eyes, his forehead sweaty. "It all happened 40-odd years ago. I don't know anything about what happened. I never did."
The harried Donna reappeared. "Kirsty'll mind the front door," she said, glaring at her husband.
"We'll go upstairs. Loch na Garra's empty. We can't go in ours," she added to Strike and Robin, pointing towards the basement. "Me grandkids are down there playing computer games."
Douthwaite hitched up his waistband and threw a wild look outside the net curtains, as though contemplating flight.
"Come on," said Donna fiercely,
and with a return to his hangdog look, he followed his wife out of the door. Kirsty passed them, heading for the ground floor, as they climbed the steep tartan stairs, Strike making liberal use of the banister to haul himself up. He'd hoped Loch na Garra might be on the first floor, but he was disappointed. It lay, as the name might have suggested, right at the top of the B&B and faced out of the rear of the building. The furniture inside was made of cheap pine. Kirsty had arranged towels in the shape of kissing swans on the maroon bedspread, which matched the pattern wallpaper of maroon and deep purple. Leads dangled from behind the wall-mounted TV. A plastic kettle sat in the corner on a low table beside the Corby trouser press. Through the window, Strike glimpsed the sea at last, a gleaming golden bar lying low between buildings in the misty haze created by the net curtains. Donna crossed the room and took the only chair. Her hands were gripping her own upper arm so tightly that the flesh showed white.
"You can sit down," she told Strike and Robin.
Having nowhere else to do it, both sat down on the end of the double bed, with its slippery maroon cover. Douthwaite remained at the door, back against it, arms folded, displaying the hourglass tattoo.
"Diamond, Jacks, Douthwaite,"
Donna recited.
"How many other names have you had?"
"None,"
said Douthwaite, trying for a laugh, but failing.
"Why did you change your name from Douthwaite to Jacks?" she demanded. "Why were the police after you?"
"They weren't after me," croaked Douthwaite. "This was ages ago. I wanted a fresh start, that's all."
"How many fresh starts does one man need?"
said Donna.
"What did you do? Why did you have to give a police statement?"
"A doctor went missing," said Douthwaite.
with a glance at Strike. "What doctor? When?"
"Her name was Margot Bamborough."
"Bamborough?" repeated Donna, her forehead bifurcated by that deep frown line. "But that was all over the news?"
"They interviewed all the patients she'd seen before she disappeared," Douthwaite said quickly. "It was routine. They didn't have anything on me."
"You must think I was born bloody yesterday," said Donna. "They," she pointed at Strike and Robin, "haven't tracked you down because it was routine inquiries, have they? You didn't change your bloody name because it was routine inquiries. Screwing her, were you?"
"No, I wasn't bloody screwing her," said Douthwaite, with his first sign of fight. "Mr. Douthwaite," began Strike.
"Diamond,"
said Douthwaite, more in desperation than in anger. "I'd be grateful if you'd read through your police statement, see whether you've got anything to add."
Douthwaite looked as though he'd have liked to refuse, but after a slight hesitation, he took the pieces of paper and began to read. The statement was a long one, covering as it did the suicide of Joanna Hammond, his married ex-lover, the beating he'd endured at the hands of her husband, the anxiety and depression which had led to so many visits to the St. John's surgery, his assertion that he'd felt nothing more for Margot Bamborough than mild gratitude for her clinical expertise, his denial that he'd ever brought or sent her gifts, and his feeble alibi for the time of her disappearance.
"Yeah, I've got nothing to add to that," Douthwaite said at last, holding the pieces of paper back out to Strike.
"I want to read it," said Donna at once.
"It's got nothing to do with... It's 40 years ago. It's nothing," said Douthwaite.
"Your real name's Douthwaite, and I never knew till 5 minutes ago. I've got a right to know who you are," she said fiercely. "I've got a right to know, so I can decide whether I was a bloody mug to stay with you after the last..."
"Fine, read it, go on," said Douthwaite, with unconvincing bravado, and Strike handed the statement over to Donna.
She'd read for barely a minute when she burst out, "You were sleeping with a married, and she killed herself!"
"I wasn't, we weren't, once it happened, once. Nobody kills themselves over that."
"Why'd she do it then? Why?"
"Her husband was a bastard."
"My husband's a bastard. I haven't taught myself."
"Christ's sake, Donna. What happened?"
"It was nothing," said Douthwaite. "We used to hang out together, a few of the lads at work and their wives and whatever. And one night I was out with some other mates and ran into Joanna, who was with some girlfriends, and some cunt tipped off her husband we'd left the pub together, and then this doctor disappeared and all, and the police came calling."
Donna got to her feet, Douthwaite's crumpled statement quivering in her hand. Still sitting on the slippery maroon coverlet, Robin remembered the day she'd found Sarah Shadlock's diamond earring in her bed, and thought she knew a little, a very little, of what Donna was experiencing.
"I knew you were a bloody cheat and a liar, but 3 girlfriends dead! One's a tragedy," said Donna furiously, and Strike wondered whether they were about to hear a Wildean epigram. "But 3! How bloody unlucky can one man get?"
"I never had anything going on with that doctor."
"You'd try it on with anyone!" shrieked Donna. And addressing Robin, she said, "Year before last, I catch him in a guest bedroom with one of my best friends."
"Christ's sake, Donna," whimpered Douthwaite.
"And 6 months ago,
Donna,
I find out he's been sneaking around with one of our regulars, and now,"
said Donna, advancing on Douthwaite, his statements clutched in her fists,
"you creepy bastard! What happened to all these women?" "I had nothing to do with any of them dying, fuck's sake," said Douthwaite, trying for an incredulous laugh and merely looking terrified. "Donna, come on. You think I'm some kind of murderer? You expect me to believe?"
To Strike's surprise, Robin suddenly jumped to her feet. Taking Donna by the shoulders, she guided her back into her chair. "Put your head down," Robin was saying. "Head down." When Robin moved to untie Donna's apron, which was tight around her waist, and Strike saw that Donna's forehead, which was all he could see now she had sunk her face into her hands, was as white as the net curtains behind her.
"Donna,"
said Douthwaite feebly, but his wife whispered,
"You stay away from me, you bastard!"
"Breathe," Robin was saying, crouching beside Donna's chair. "Get her some water," she told Strike, who got up and went into the tiny shower room where a plastic beaker sat in a holder over the sink. Almost as pale as his wife, Douthwaite watched as Robin persuaded Donna to drink.
"Stay there now," Robin told the landlady, one hand resting on her shoulder. "Don't get up."
"Did he have something to do with them dying?"
Donna whispered, looking sideways at Robin, her pupils enormous with shock.
"That's what we're here to find out," Robin murmured back.
She turned and looked meaningfully at Strike, who silently agreed that the best thing he could do for the stricken Donna was to get information out of Douthwaite.
"We've got a number of questions we'd like to ask you," Strike told him. "Obviously you're not obliged to answer them, but I put it to you that it would be in the best interests of everyone, yourself included, to cooperate."
"What questions?" said Douthwaite, still flat against the door.
Then, in a torrent of words, he said, "I never hurt anyone, never. I'm not a violent man, Donna will tell you. I never laid a finger on her in anger. That's not who I am."
But when Strike merely continued to look at him, Douthwaite said pleadingly,
"Look, I've told you. With Joanna, it was a one-night stand. I was just a kid," he said.
And in an echo of Irene Hickson, he said,
"You do those kind of things when you're young, don't you?"
"And when you're old," whispered Donna,
"and all the bloody years in between."
"Where were you," Strike asked Douthwaite, "when Joanna killed herself?"
"In Brent," said Douthwaite, "miles away, and I have witnesses to prove it. We used to work in pairs, selling, each do one side of the street, and I was out with a bloke called Tadger."
And he tried to laugh again. Nobody smiled.
"Tadger, you can imagine the grief he... Well, he was with me all day. Got back to the office late in the afternoon, and there was a group of lads in there. And they told us Hammond had just got the message his wife had topped herself."
"Terrible," said the pale and sweating Douthwaite.
"But except for that one night together, I had nothing to do with it. But her old man, well, it was easier to blame me," said Douthwaite, "wasn't it, than think about his own bloody behaviour. I got home a couple of nights later and he was lying in wait. Ambush. He beat the shit out of me."
"Good," said Donna, on a half-sob.
"And your neighbour, Janice, the nurse, looked after."
"Straight off with the neighbour, were you, Steve?" said Donna, with a hollow laugh. "Get the nurse to mop you up?"
"It wasn't like that," said Douthwaite, with surprising vehemence.
"It's his little trick,"
the white-faced Donna told Robin, who was still kneeling by her chair.
"Always got a sob story on the go. Fell for it myself, heartbroken after the love of his life drowned. Oh, my God!"
Donna whispered, slowly shaking her head.
"And she was the third." With a hysterical little laugh, she said, "As far as we know, maybe there are others. Who knows?"
"Christ's sake, Donna," said Douthwaite yet again.
Patches of underarm sweat were visible through his thin turquoise T-shirt. Strike could literally smell his fear.
"Come on, you know me. You know I'd never hurt anyone."
"Janice says she advised you to see the doctor about your simp—"
"She never told me to go to the doctor," snapped Douthwaite, one eye on his wife. "I didn't need telling. I went off my own bat because I was just getting worried about the headaches and... mostly headaches. I felt really bad."
"You visited Margot 6 times in 1 2-week period," said Strike.
"I felt ill. Stomach pains and what have you. I mean, it obviously affected me, Joanna dying, and then people talking about me."
"Oh, poor you. Poor you," murmured Donna. "Jesus effing Christ. You hate going to the doctor. 6 times in 2 weeks."
"Donna, come on," said Douthwaite imploringly. "I was feeling like shit. And then the bloody police come and make out like I was stalking her or something. It was all my health."
"Did you buy her—" began Strike.
"Chocolates? No," said Douthwaite, who suddenly seemed very agitated.
"If someone sent her chocolates, maybe you should find them, but it wasn't me. I told the police I never bought her anything. It weren't like that.
Witnesses said you seemed distressed and possibly angry the last time you left Dr. Bamber's surgery," said Strike. "What happened during that last visit?"
Douthwaite's breath was coming fast now. Suddenly, almost aggressively, he looked directly into Strike's eyes. Experienced in the body language of suspects who yearn for the release and relief of unburdening themselves, no matter the consequences, Strike suddenly knew
that Douthwaite was teetering on the brink of a disclosure. He'd have given almost anything to spirit the man away now, to a quiet interrogation room, but exactly as he'd feared, the precious moment was snatched away by Donna.
"Turned you down, did she? What did you think, Steve? A scrubby little failed salesman had a chance with a doctor?"
"I wasn't bloody looking for a chance," said Douthwaite, rounding on his wife. "I was there for my health. I was in a state."
"He's like a bloody tomcat," Donna told Robin, "slinking around behind everyone's backs. He'll use anything to get his end away. Anything. His girlfriend's topped herself, and he's using it to chat up nurses and doctors."
"I wasn't. I was ill."
"That last meeting," Strike began again.
"I don't know what you're on about. It was nothing,"
Douthwaite said, now avoiding looking Strike in the face.
"The doc was just telling me to take it easy."
"Like you ever needed telling that, you lazy bastard," spat Donna.
"Perhaps," said Strike, "as you're feeling unwell, Mrs. Diamond, I could speak to Steve somewhere separate."
"Oh, no you don't," said Donna. "No way. I won't."
She exploded into tears, shoulders sagging, face in her hands.
"I'm going to hear it all now. Last chance."
"Donna," said Douthwaite plaintively.
"Don't,"
she sobbed into her fingers. "Don't you dare." "Perhaps," said Strike, hoping to return to the last visit with Margot in due course, "we could go over your alibi for the time Dr. Bamber had disappeared." Donna was sobbing, tears and mucus flowing freely now. Robin grabbed a paper napkin off the tray beside the kettle and handed it to her. Cowed by his wife's distress, Douthwaite allowed Strike to lead him back over his shaky alibi for the evening in question, sticking to the story that he'd been sitting unnoticed in a cafe, scanning the newspapers for flats to rent.
"I wanted to clear out, get away from all the gossip about Joanna. I just wanted to get away."
"So the desire to move wasn't triggered by anything that passed between you and Dr. Bamborough during your last visit?" Strike asked.
"No," said Douthwaite, still not looking at Strike. "How could it be?"
"Given up on her?"
Donna asked from behind the wet napkin with which she was blotting her eyes.
"Knew he'd made a fool of himself. Shame was with that young lassie from Leeds, eh, Steve?"
"Donna, for fuck's sake, he forgets,"
Donna said to Robin.
"He's not that cocky little sod in his 20s anymore. Deluded, baldy bastard,"
she sobbed.
"Donna, so you moved to Waltham Forest?" prompted Strike.
"Yeah, police press. It was a nightmare," said Douthwaite. "I thought of ending it, to tell you the shame you didn't," said Donna savagely. "Save us all a lot of time and trouble."
As though he hadn't heard this, and ignoring Douthwaite's look of outrage, Strike asked,
"What made you go to Clacton-on-Sea? Did you have family there?"
"I haven't got family. I grew up in Care."
"Oh, someone pass him a bloody violin," said Donna.
"Well, it's true, isn't it?"
said Douthwaite, displaying unvarnished anger for the first time.
"And I'm allowed to tell the truth about my own bloody life, aren't I? I just wanted to be a redcoat, because I sing a bit, and it looked like a fun way to earn a living."
"Fun?"
muttered Donna. "Oh, yeah, as long as you're having fun, Steve. Get away from people treating me like I killed someone."
"And whoops," said Donna, "there's another one gone, in the pool."
"You know bloody well I had nothing to do with Julie drowning."
"How could I know?" said Donna. "I wasn't there. It was before we even met."
"I showed you the story in the paper," said Douthwaite.
"I showed you, Donna, come on."
He turned to Strike. "A bunch of us were drinking in our chalet. Me and some mates were playing poker. Julie was tired. She left before we finished our game, walked back to her chalet. She walked round the pool, slipped in the dark, knocked herself out, and..." For the first time, Douthwaite showed real distress.
"She drowned. I won't ever forget it, never. I ran outside in me underpants next morning when I heard the shouting. I saw her body when they were taking her out of the pool. You don't forget something like that. She was a kid, 22 or something. Her parents came and it was a horrible thing, horrible. I never... that someone can go like that, a slip and a trip. Yeah, so that's when I applied for a job at the Ingermills Butlins up the road from here. And that's where I met Donna,"
he said, with an apprehensive glance at his wife.
"So you leaving Clacton-on-Sea and changing your name again had nothing to do with a man called Oakden
coming to question you about Margot Bamborough?" asked Strike.
Donna's head jerked up.
"Oh, my God," she said. "So even the Julie bit's a lie."
"It's not a lie," said Douthwaite loudly. "I told you Julie and I had an argument a couple of days before she died. I told you that because I felt so guilty after. This man, this... what'd you say his name was? Oakden? Yeah. He turned up, saying he was writing a book about Dr. Bamborough disappearing. Went round all the other redcoats talking to them about me, telling them all I'd been a suspect and how I changed me name afterwards, making me sound dodgy as hell. And Julie was really pissed off with me because I hadn't told her."
"Well, you really learned that lesson, didn't you, Steve?" said Donna. "Run and hide, that's all you know. And when you're found out, you just sneak off and find some other woman to whine to, unless she finds you out, and then..."
"Mr. Douthwaite," said Strike, cutting across Donna,
"I want to thank you for your time. I know it's been a shock, having all this raked up again."
Robin looked up at Strike, astonished. He couldn't be leaving the interview here, surely. The Douthwaites, or Diamonds as they thought of themselves, looked similarly taken aback. Strike extracted a second card from his pocket and held it out to Douthwaite.
"If you remember anything," the detective said, "you know where to find me. It's never too late."
The hourglass tattoo on Douthwaite's forearm rippled as he held out his hand for the card.
"Who else have you talked to?" Douthwaite asked Strike.
Now that his ordeal was over, he seemed curiously averse to it ending. Perhaps, thought Robin, he feared being alone with his wife.
"Margot's husband and family," said Strike, watching Douthwaite's reactions. "The co-workers who were still alive. Dr. Gupta, one of the receptionists, Irene Hickson. Janice Beattie, the nurse."
"That's nice," piped up Donna. "The nurse is still available, Steve."
"An ex-boyfriend of Margot's, her best friend, and a few other people."
Douthwaite, who'd flushed at his wife's interjection, said,
"Not Dennis Creed?"
"Not yet," said Strike.
"Well," he looked from husband to wife, "thanks for your time. We appreciate it."
Robin got to her feet. "I'm sorry," she said quietly to Donna. "I hope you feel better."
"Thanks,"
mumbled Donna. As Strike and Robin reached the top of the stairs, they heard shouting break out again behind the door of Loch Na Garr.
"Donna, babes, don't you dare call me babes, you fucking bastard!"
"No point carrying on," said Strike quietly,
setting off down the steep tartan stairs as slowly as the obese old lady had moved.
"He's not going to say it with her there."
"Say what?"
"Well, that," said Strike, as the Douthwaite's shouts echoed down the stairs, "is the question, isn't it?"
Chapter 65. Like as a ship that through the ocean wide directs her course unto one certain cost, is met of many a counterwind and tide, with which her winged speed is let and crossed, and she herself in stormy surges tossed, yet making many a board and many a bay, still winneth way, ne hath her compass lost. Right so it fares with me in this long way, whose course is often stayed, yet never is astray. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen.
"I'm hungry," Strike announced, once they'd stepped down onto the sunny pavement outside the Allardyce.
"Let's get some fish and chips," said Robin.
"Now you're talking," said Strike enthusiastically, as they headed off towards the end of Scarborough Avenue.
"Cormoran, what makes you think Douthwaite knows something?"
"Didn't you see the way he looked at me when I asked him about his last appointment with Margot?"
"I must have been looking at Donna. I was seriously worried she was going to pass out."
"Wish she had," said Strike.
"Strike,
he was definitely thinking about telling me something. Then she bloody ruined it."
As they reached the end of the road, he said,
"That was a scared man, and I don't think he's only scared of his wife. Do we go left or right?"
"Right," said Robin, as they headed off along Grand Parade, passing a long open-fronted building called Funland, which was full of beeping and flashing video games, claw machines, and coin-operated mechanical horses for children to ride.
"Are you saying Douthwaite's guilty?"
"I think he feels it," Strike said,
as they wove their way in and out of cheerful, T-shirted families and couples. He looked at me back there as though he was bursting to tell me something that's weighing on him. If he had actual evidence, why didn't he tell the police? It would have got them off his back. I can think of one reason. He was scared of the person he thought had killed her.
Exactly.
So, Luca Ricci, said Robin. At that moment, a male voice from the depths of Funland called,
White 7 and 4, 74!
Possibly, said Strike, though he didn't sound entirely convinced. Douthwaite and Ricci were living in the same area at the time, maybe going to the same pubs. I suppose he might have heard a rumour about Ricci being out together, but that doesn't fit with the eyewitness accounts, does it? If Douthwaite was issuing the warning, you'd think it'd be Margot looking distressed afterwards, whereas we know he was the one who came running out of there looking scared and worried. But my gut feeling is that Douthwaite thinks whatever happened between them at that last appointment is relevant to her disappearance. The entrance to a well-maintained park on their right was ablaze with petunias. Ahead, on an island in the middle of a traffic island, stood a 60-foot-high clock tower of brick and stone, with a faintly Gothic appearance and faces like a miniature Big Ben. "Exactly how many chippies has Skegness got?" asked Strike, as they came to a halt on the busy intersection beside the clock tower. They were standing right beside two establishments which had tables spilling out onto the pavement, and he could see a further two fish-and-chip shops on the other side of the junction. "I never counted," said Robin. "I was always more interested in the donkeys. Should we try here?" she asked, pointing at the nearest free table, which was pistachio green and belonged to Tony's Chippy. We sell on quality, not price.
"Donkeys," repeated Strike, grinning, as he sat down on the bench.
"That's right," said Robin.
"Cod or haddock?"
"Haddock, please," said Strike, and Robin headed into the chip shop to order. After a minute or so, looking forward to his chips and enjoying the feeling of sun on his back, Strike became aware that he was still watching Robin and fixed his eyes instead on a fluttering mass just above him. Even though the top of the yellow railing separating Tony's from Harry Ramsbottom's had been fitted with fine spikes to stop birds landing on them, a handful of speckled starlings were doing just that, delicately poised between the needles and balanced in the iron circles just below them, waiting for the chance to swoop on an abandoned chip. Watching the birds, Strike wondered what the chances were of Douthwaite ringing the number on his card. He was a man with a long track record of hiding from his past, but Strike had definitely read in his face a desperation he'd only ever seen in the faces of men who could no longer bear the pressure of a terrible secret. Idly rubbing his chin, Strike decided to give the man a short period of grace, then either call him again or even return unannounced to Skegness, where he might waylay Douthwaite in the street or a pub, where Donna couldn't interfere. Strike was still watching the starlings when Robin set down two polystyrene trays, two small wooden forks, and two cans of Coke on the table.
"Mushy peas," said Strike, looking at Robin's tray, where a hefty dollop of what looked like green porridge sat alongside her fish and chips.
"Yorkshire caviar," said Robin, sitting down. "I didn't think you'd want any."
"You were right," said Strike, picking up a sachet of tomato sauce while watching with something like revulsion as Robin dipped a chip into the green sludge and ate it.
"Soft southerner you are," she said, and Strike laughed.
"Don't ever let Polwarth hear you say that," he said,
breaking off a bit of fish with his fingers, dipping it in ketchup and eating it. He then, without warning, broke into song.
"A good sword and a trusty hand, a merry heart and true. King James's men shall understand what Cornish lads can do."
"What on earth's that?" asked Robin, laughing.
"First verse of the Song of the Western Men," said Strike. "The gist is that Cornish men are the antithesis of soft bastards."
"Bloody hell, this is good."
"I know. You don't get fish and chips like this in London," said Robin. For a few minutes they ate in silence. The greaseproof paper in which the trays of chips were wrapped was printed with old pages of the Mirror newspaper. Paul quits the Beatles. There were cartoons, too, of the dirty postcard type,
a busty blonde in bed with her elderly boss was saying, "Business must be booming. You've never given me so much overtime." It reminded her of Gemma, the PA, who'd perhaps already called the fake number Robin had given her, and realized that it wasn't only her ex, Andy, who wasn't all he appeared to be. But Robin had a recording on her phone of everything Gemma knew about Shifty's insider trading, and Pat, at that moment, was transcribing it into a document shorn of anything that might identify the informant. Shifty, Robin hoped, would soon be jobless and, with any luck, in court. A long stretch of fairground rides on the other side of the road hid the sea from her sight. The seats of the distant Ferris wheel were enclosed in casings shaped like pastel-coloured hot air balloons. Nearby stood a gigantic climbing frame for adults, with ropes and swinging tyres, 100 feet up in the air. Watching the harnessed people navigating the obstacles, Robin felt a strange mixture of contentment and melancholy. The possibility of an unknown development in the Bamborough case, the delicious chips and peas, the companionship of Strike, and the sunshine were all cheering. But she was also remembering chasing along the out-of-sight beach as a small child, trying to outrun her brother Stephen to reach the donkeys and have first pick. Why did the memory of innocence sting so much as you got older? Why did the memory of the child who'd thought she was invulnerable, who'd never known cruelty, give her more pain than pleasure? Her childhood had been happy, unlike Strike's. It ought not to hurt. Over the space of summer weekends spread years apart, Robin and her brothers had competed to ride the black donkey called Noddy, who was doubtless long gone. Was it mortality, then, which turned cheerful memories bittersweet? Maybe, Robin thought, she'd bring Annabel here when she was old enough and treat her to her first donkey ride. It was a nice idea, but she doubted Stephen and Jenny would see Skegness as a desirable weekend destination. Annabel's great-aunt had moved away from Boston. There was no longer any family connection to the area. Times changed, and so did childhoods.
"You all right?" said Strike, watching Robin's face.
"Fine," she said, "just thinking. I'm going to be 30 in a few weeks."
Strike snorted.
"Well, you're getting no sympathy from me," he said. "I'll be 40 the month after."
He snapped open his can of Coke and drank. Robin watched a family pass, all four eating ice creams, accompanied by a waddling dachshund that was nosing the Union Jack carrier bag, which swung from the father's hand. "Do you think Scotland's going to leave?"
"Go for independence, maybe," said Strike. "The polls are close. Barclay thinks it could happen. He was telling me about some old mates of his at home. They sound just like Polwarth. Same hate figures, same promises everything'll be rainbows and unicorns if only they cut themselves free of London. Anyone pointing out pitfalls or difficulties is scaremongering. Experts don't know anything. Facts lie. Things can't be any worse than they are."
Strike put several chips in his mouth, chewed, swallowed, then said,
"But life's taught me things can always get worse than they are. I thought I had it hard. Then they wheeled a bloke onto the ward who'd had both his legs and his genitals blown off."
He'd never before talked to Robin about the aftermath of his life-changing injury. Indeed, he rarely mentioned his missing leg. A barrier had definitely fallen, Robin thought, since their whiskey-fueled talk in the dark office.
"Everyone wants a single, simple solution," he said, now finishing his last few chips. "One weird trick to lose belly fat. I've never clicked on it, but I understand the appeal."
"Well, reinvention's such an inviting idea, isn't it?" said Robin, her eyes on the fake hot air balloons circling on their prescribed course. "Look at Douthwaite, changing his name and finding a new woman every few years. Reinventing a whole country would feel amazing, being part of that."
"Yeah," said Strike. "Of course, people think if they subsume themselves in something bigger, and that changes, they'll change too."
"Well, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be better, or different, is there?" asked Robin. "Nothing wrong with wanting to improve things."
"Not at all," said Strike. "But people who fundamentally change are rare, in my experience, because it's bloody hard work compared to going on a march or waving a flag. Have we met a single person on this case who's radically different to the person they were 40 years ago?"
"I don't know. I think I've changed,"
said Robin, then felt embarrassed to have said it out loud. Strike looked at her without smiling for the space it took him to chew and swallow a chip, then said,
"Yeah, but you're exceptional, aren't you?"
And before Robin had time for anything other than a slight blush, Strike said,
"Are you not finishing those chips?"
"Help yourself," said Robin, shoving the tray towards him. She pulled her phone out of her pocket. "I'll look up that one weird tip to lose belly fat." Strike smirked. After wiping her hands on her paper napkin, Robin checked her emails. "Have you seen this from Vanessa Equenzi? She's coppered you in."
"What?"
"She might know someone who could replace Morris. Woman called Michelle Greenstreet. She wants to leave the police. She's been in 8 years," said Robin, scrolling slowly down the email. "Not enjoying response policing. She's in Manchester, wants to relocate to London. Very keen on the detective side."
"Sounds promising," said Strike. "Let's schedule an interview. She already cleared the first hurdle with flying colours."
"What hurdle?" said Robin, looking up.
"Doubt she's ever sent a dick pic."
He patted his pockets, pulled out his packet of Benson and Hedges, but found it empty.
"I need more fags. Let's..."
"Wait," said Robin, who was still staring down at her mobile. "Oh, my God! Cormoran! Gloria Conti's emailed me."
"You're kidding," said Strike.
Having partly risen, he now let himself fall back onto the bench. "Dear Miss Ellicott," Robin read aloud, "I'm sorry I haven't answered your emails. I wasn't aware you were trying to contact me, and I've only just found out. If convenient, I'd be available to talk to you tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. Yours sincerely." "And she's given a phone number," said Robin, looking up at Strike, astonished. "How can she only just have found out? It's been months of me emailing her without any response. Unless Anna's prompted her."
"Could be," said Strike. "Which doesn't suggest someone who wants the investigation over."
"Of course she doesn't," said Robin. "But for sanity's sake, you'd have to draw the line somewhere."
"So what does that make us?"
Robin smiled and shook her head. "Dedicated?"
"Conti. Last person to see Margot alive. Closest person to Margot at the practice."
"I'm thanking her," said Robin, who was typing fast onto her mobile, "and agreeing to the call tomorrow."
"We could do it from the office together," said Strike. "Maybe FaceTime her, if she's agreeable."
"I'll ask," said Robin, still typing. They set off a few minutes later in search of cigarettes, Robin reflecting on how casually she'd just agreed to go into work on a Saturday evening so she could conduct Gloria's interview with Strike. There was no angry Matthew at home anymore, furious about her committing herself to long hours, suspicious about what she and Strike were up to, alone in the office in the evening. And she thought back to Matthew's refusal to look her in the eye across the table at the mediation. He changed his partner and his firm. He'd soon be a father. His life had changed, but had he? They turned the corner to find themselves facing what Strike mentally categorized as acres of tat. As far as the eye could see were racks of merchandise laid out on the pavement. Beach balls, key rings, cheap jewellery, sunglasses, buckets of candy floss, fudge and plush toys.
"Look at that," said Robin suddenly, pointing to her right. A bright yellow sign read, "Your life within your hands."
On the dark glass of the door below was written, "Palm reader, clairvoyant," along with a circular chart, all 12 signs of the zodiac represented by the glyphs around a central sun.
"What?" said Strike.
"Well, you've had your chart done. Maybe I'd like mine."
"Fuck's sake,"
muttered Strike, and they walked on, Robin smiling to herself. She waited outside, examining postcards, while Strike entered the newsagents to buy cigarettes. Waiting to be served, Strike was seized by a sudden quixotic impulse, stimulated no doubt by the gaudy colour all around him, by the sunshine and sticks of rock, the rattle and clang of amusement arcades, and a stomach full of some of the best fish and chips he'd ever eaten, to buy Robin a toy donkey. He came to his senses almost before the idea had formed. What was he? A kid on a daytime date with his first girlfriend? Emerging again into the sunlight as he left the shop, he noted that he couldn't have bought a donkey if he'd wanted to. There wasn't a single one in sight. The bins full of plushies held only unicorns. "Back to the car, then?" said Robin.
"Yeah," said Strike,
ripping the cellophane off his cigarettes. But then he said, "We'll go down to the sea before we head off, shall we?"
"Okay," said Robin, surprised. Why?
"Just fancy it. It's wrong, being by the sea without actually laying eyes on it."
"Is this a Cornish thing?" asked Robin, as they headed back to Grand Parade.
"Maybe," said Strike, lighting the cigarette between his teeth.
He took a drag on his cigarette, exhaled, then sang,
"And when we come to London Wall, a pleasant sight to view, come forth, ye cowards all, here's men as good as you."
The Song of the Western Men?
That's the one.
Why do you think they feel the need to tell Londoners they're just as good? Isn't that a given?
"Just London, isn't it?" said Strike, as they crossed the road. "Pisses everyone off."
"I love London."
"Me too, but I can see why it pisses everyone off."
They passed a fountain with a statue in the middle of the Jolly Fisherman, that rotund, bearded sailor skipping along in high wind, who'd been used on posters advertising Skegness for nearly a century, and progressed across a smooth paved area towards the beach. At last they saw what Strike had felt the need to see. A wide expanse of flat ocean, the colour of chalcedony beneath a periwinkle sky. Far out at sea, spoiling the horizon, were an army of tall white wind turbines, and while Strike personally enjoyed the chill breeze coming off the wide ocean, he understood at last why Robin had brought a scarf. Strike smoked in silence, the cool wind making no difference whatsoever to his curly hair. He was thinking about Joan. It hadn't occurred to him until this moment that her plan for her final resting place had given them a grave to visit any time they were at the British coast. Cornish-born, Cornish-bred, Joan had known that this need to reconnect with the sea lived in all of them. Now, every time they made their way to the coast, they paid her tribute, along with the obeisance due to the waves.
"They were Joan's favourites, pink roses," he said, after a while. "What you sent to the funeral."
"Oh, really?" said Robin. I had a kind of picture in my head of Joan, from things you'd told me, and pink roses seemed to suit her."
"If the agency ever fails," said Strike, as they both turned away from the sea, "you could come back to Skegness and set yourself up as a clairvoyant."
"Bit niche," said Robin, as they walked back towards the car park, guessing dead people's favourite flowers.
"No donkeys," said Strike, glancing back over his shoulder at the beach.
"Never mind," said Robin kindly. "I think you'd have been a bit heavy."
Chapter 66. "Speak, thou frail woman, speak with confidence." Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. The following evening, Strike and Robin sat down together on the same side of the partner's desk. They were alone in the office for the first time since the night Strike had given her two black eyes. The lights were on this time. There were no glasses of whiskey in their hands, but each of them was very conscious of what had happened on the previous occasion, and both felt a slight self-consciousness, which manifested itself, on Strike's side, in a slightly brisker tone as they set up the computer monitor so that both could see it well, and on Robin's, in focusing herself on all the questions she wanted to ask Gloria. At 6 o'clock, which was 7 o'clock Gloria's time, Strike dialed Gloria's number, and after a moment's suspense, they heard ringing, and a woman appeared on screen, looking slightly nervous, in what looked like a book-lined study. Framed on the wall behind her was a large photograph of a family. Gloria herself, a distinguished-looking husband, and three adult children, all wearing white shirts, all of them notably attractive. Of all the people they'd met and interviewed in connection with Margot Bamborough, Gloria Conti, Robin thought, looked most like her younger self, although she hadn't made any obvious efforts to disguise the aging process. Her hair, which was pure white, had been cut into a short and flattering bob. Although there were fine lines on her brow and around her eyes, her fair complexion seemed never to have been exposed to much sun. She was slim and high-cheekboned, so that the structure of her face was much as it had been when she was younger, and her high-necked navy shirt, small gold earrings, and square-framed glasses were stylish and simple. Robin thought that Gloria looked far more like her idea of a college professor than the scion of a criminal family, but perhaps she was being influenced by the lines of books on the shelves behind her.
"Good evening," said Gloria nervously.
"Good evening," said Strike and Robin together. "It's very good of you to talk to us, Mrs. Joubert," said Strike. "We appreciate it."
"Oh, not at all," she said politely. Robin hadn't imagined received pronunciation from Irene Hickson's description of a girl from a rough background, but of course, as with Paul Satchwell, Gloria had now spent longer outside the country of her birth than in it.
"We've been hoping to talk to you for a long time," said Robin.
"Yes, I'm very sorry about that," said Gloria. "My husband, Hugo, didn't tell me about any of your messages, you see. I found your last email in the trash folder by accident. That's how I realized you were trying to contact me. Hugo, well, he thought he was doing the right thing." Robin was reminded of that occasion when Matthew had deleted a voicemail from Strike on Robin's phone in an attempt to stop Robin going back to work at the agency. She was surprised to see Gloria didn't seem to hold her husband's intervention against him. Perhaps Gloria could read her mind, because she said, "Hugo assumed I wouldn't want to talk about what happened with strangers. He didn't realize that actually you're the only people I'd ever want to talk to, because you're trying to find out what really happened. And if you succeed, it'll be... well, it would lift a huge weight off me."
"Do you mind if I take notes?" Strike asked her.
"No, not at all," said Gloria politely.
As Strike clicked out the nib of his pen, Gloria reached out of shot for a large glass of red wine, took a sip, appeared to brace herself, and said rather quickly,
"Please, if you don't mind, could I explain some things first? Since yesterday I've been going over it in my head, and I think if I tell you my story it will save you a lot of time. It's key to understanding my relationship with Margot, and why I behaved as I behaved."
"That'd be very helpful," said Strike, pen poised. "Please, go on."
Gloria took another sip of wine, put her glass back where they couldn't see it, drew a deep breath and said, "Both my parents died in a house fire when I was 5.
"How awful," said Robin, startled.
The 1961 census record had shown a complete family of 4.
"I'm so sorry."
Strike gave a kind of commiserative growl.
"Thank you," said Gloria.
"I'm only telling you that to explain. You see, I survived because my father threw me out of the window into a blanket the neighbours were holding. My mother and father didn't jump because they were trying to reach my elder brother, who was trapped. All 3 of them died, so I was raised by my mother's parents. They were adorable people. They'd have sold their own souls for me, which makes everything I'm about to say even worse. I was quite a shy girl. I really envied the girls at school who had parents who were, you know, with it. My poor granny didn't really understand the 60s and 70s, said Gloria with a sad smile. My clothes were always a bit old-fashioned. No miniskirts or eye makeup, you know. I reacted by developing a very elaborate fantasy life. I know most teenagers are fantasists, but I was extreme. Everything sort of spun out of control when I was 16, and I went to see the movie The Godfather. It's ridiculous, said Gloria soberly, but it's the truth. I cleaved to that movie. I became obsessed with it. I don't know how many times I saw it. At least 20, I expect. I was an English schoolgirl from 70s Islington, but what I really wanted was to be Apollonia from 40s Sicily, and meet a handsome American mafioso, and not to be blown up by a car bomb, but go and live with Michael Corleone in New York, and be beautiful and glamorous while my husband did glamorously violent criminal things, all underpinned, you know, by a strict moral code. Strike and Robin both laughed, but Gloria didn't smile. On the contrary, she looked sad and ashamed. I somehow thought all this might be achievable, she went on, because I had an Italian surname. I'd never really cared about that before The Godfather. Now, out of nowhere, I asked my grandparents to take me to the Italian church on Clerkenwell Road for Mass, instead of their regular church. And bless them, they did. I wish they hadn't. I wish they'd told me not to be so selfish, because their regular church gave them a lot of support, and it was the centre of their social life. I'd always felt entirely English, which I was on my mum's side. But now I started trying to find out as much as I could about my dad's family. I hoped to find out I was descended from mafiosi. Then I could get my grandparents to give me the money to go and meet them all in Sicily, and maybe marry a distant cousin. But all I found out was that my Italian grandfather immigrated to London to work in a coffee shop. I already knew my dad had worked for London Transport. Everyone I found out about, no matter how far back I went, was completely respectable and law-abiding. It was a real disappointment, said Gloria, with a sigh. Then one Sunday at St. Peter's, somebody pointed out a man called Niccolò Ricci, sitting at the back of the Italian church. They said he was one of the very last of the Little Italy gangsters. Gloria paused to take another mouthful of wine, replaced the glass out of shot again, then said, "Anyway, Ricci had sons." Strike now set pen to paper for the first time. "There wasn't much resemblance, really, between Luca Ricci and Al Pacino," said Gloria dryly. "But I managed to find one. He was 4 years older than I was, and everyone I asked about him said he was trouble, which was exactly what I wanted to hear. It started with a few smiles in passing. We went on our first date a couple of months before I was due to sit my exams. I told Granny and Gramps I was revising at a school friend's house. I'd always been such a good girl. They never dreamed I could be fibbing. I desperately wanted to like Luca, because this was my way into my fantasy. He had a car, and he was definitely criminal. He didn't tell me anything about summit meetings between heads of crime families, though. Mostly he talked about his Fiat and drugs and beating people up. After a few dates, it was obvious Luca was quite keen on me. Or no, said Gloria, unsmiling, not keen, because that implies genuine affection. He really just wanted to fix me down, to keep me his. I was so stupid and lost to my fantasy. I found that quite exciting, because it seemed, you know, the proper mafioso attitude. But I liked Luca best when I wasn't actually with him, when I was mixing him up with Michael Corleone in my head, in my bed at night. I stopped studying. My fantasy life took me over completely. Gangsters, moles didn't need A-levels. Luca didn't think I needed A-levels either. I failed all of them. My grandparents were really disappointed, although they were so kind about it, said Gloria. For the first time, her voice quivered slightly. Then, I think it was the following week, they found out about me seeing Luca. They were desperately worried and upset. But by this time, I didn't really care. I told them I'd given up on the idea of college. I wanted to go out to work. I only applied for the job at the St. John's practice because it was in the heart of Little Italy, even though Little Italy didn't really exist anymore. Luca's father was one of the very last relics. But it was all part of my fantasy. I was a Conti. I should be there where my forefathers had been. It made it easier to see Luca, too, because he lived there. I should never have got that receptionist's job. I was far too young and I had no experience. It was Margot who wanted me to have it. Gloria paused, and Robin was sure it was because she just had to say Margot's name for the first time. Drawing another deep breath, she said, "So there I was, on reception with Irene all day. My grandparents weren't registered at St. John's because they lived in Islington, so I got away with telling Irene a bunch of lies about my background. I'd created a whole persona by now. I told her the Contis were an old Sicilian family, how my grandfather and father had been part of a crime family, and I don't know what else. Sometimes I used bits and pieces Luca had told me about the Ricci's. Some of it was straight out of The Godfather. Ironically," said Gloria, with a slight eye roll, "the one authentically criminal thing I could have told her, I didn't. I kept my mouth shut about my boyfriend. Luca had told me never to talk about him and his family to other people, so I didn't. I took him seriously. I remember, a few months after I got the job, a rumour went round the local area that they'd found a body buried in concrete in one of the builders' sites up the road.